Welcome to the 40K Lorecast.
Welcome to 40K Lorecast with me, John Varsadia, and Brad Chester.
This guy.
Today, we're going to be continuing our coverage of the 500 World Campaign with a dive a little bit deeper, actually, into the Destroyer Plague and then the first real interactions between the Ultramarines and the emerging Necron threat in the Ultramar district, which, by the way, doesn't go great.
Also, I want to throw a quick thank you, Daryl, at the game room, because I got my 500 worlds because one of the guys working for him accidentally put Daryl's copy of 500 worlds out and I snatched it, bought it, and left with it.
Jerk.
He's like, hey, man, do you have my copy? It wasn't supposed to be out. I'm like, yeah, I gave you money for it. You're fine. He's like, whatever, Brad. God damn it.
Bring it back next week. Anyway. All right. So 40K Lorecast, weekly show in the lore of the Warhammer 40K universe, releasing every Monday at 7 p.m. Eastern. The comments and the follows, they're doing amazing things for us, guys. Thank you. We are now the number one ranked podcast. That's only because of all of you. So massive thank you for that, because the ego that gives Brad and I is very fun. We have a number of links in our show notes. We have our YouTube channel for our bi-monthly-ish Q&As. We have one coming up once Brad and I finish up some medical stuff we actually both have to get done, and then we'll pop it in there. We also have a link to our other show, The History of 40K, for those of you who want to know more about what this game was like on the tabletop. Come check that out. It's a lot of fun. We also, if you want to support us, have links to our merchandise, which are actually being updated probably by the time of release. There'll be some cool new stuff in there. And, of course, our Patreon. Our Patreon's really what's helped this show out more than anything. It's allowed us to upgrade equipment, expand out, kind of test new waters. I'll be honest, some of them were failures, but we did get to test them. But doing some more stuff like that. So thank you all for the Patreon. For those who don't know, our Patreon is $4.99 a month. For that, you get this show and the History of 40K ad-free, or 4.21 euros for our one listener in Arrecife. Yeah, I can see you. For those who are not aware of Arrecife, it's the capital of Lanzarote, which is the Canary Islands. Rising to fame in the 17th century, the Canary Islands were used as kind of a bastion against pirate attacks, even though they got attacked by pirates. But whatever, that's not important.
Not even just attacked. They got attacked by pirates a lot.
Well, they're next to the pirates. That's kind of the issue. It's like, we'll build an island here to stop the pirate attacks. Dude, the pirates are just there. They can all see you. This will go well for us, I think. But cool, fun story. The Canary Islands are not named after the bird because it's in Spanish and Canaria is dog. So it's actually the dog island, but it comes from Latin, because when the Romans got there, there were monk seals all over the place and they named it the dog island because monk seals look a lot like dogs. Fun story. So didn't know that one.
You want to talk about a fun story? Let's talk about the fact that in the background right now, I can see my trophy sitting on your...
Yeah, the trophy that Brad won and I have possession of, because what did Brad do with the trophy that he won?
I instantly forgot it because I have a tiny brain.
Yeah, so it's mine now. Ooh, two more things about Arrecife. First off, they were the first Spanish place to ban bullfighting, which was 1991, which is a lot later than I thought it would be. And they do something there that I really like. They grow grapes in volcanic soil, which makes a really cool tasting wine. I haven't had this stuff from Canary Islands, but I've had this stuff from Mount Etna, and it is delicious. All right. Last link, though, is, of course, our Discord. It's getting quite large. Really, really large, actually. And really fun. But the Ask John and Brad channel has been popping off recently. I've been having some fun in that. So thank you guys for the questions. Hopefully my answers make semblance of sense when I'm doing it between stuff. But more importantly, it's become a really good place to interact around lore, questions, etc. Really is a great place. Even people who are trying to learn the game for the first time, memes, artwork, painting, etc. We're actually probably going to expand this thing out a little bit, especially the painting section. We had a really nice painting competition a short while back. I think we're going to do some more of those because it just was kind of cool to see people interact. But anyway, with all that, let's get into the 500 worlds. In doing so, let's not talk about anything that's really in the 500 Worlds book. Let's talk about backstory, the Destroyer Curse. So it actually is in the book, but the Destroyer Curse is one of the I'm taking a guess here. My opinion is I think GW wrote themselves into a corner with the Necrons. Brett and I were discussing this beforehand. One of the problems that they have is forever, GW has been stating, if the Necrons were to fully awaken, they would smoke show the galaxy like it was nothing. Like, just not even ballpark. And then they recently made the mistake of saying, oh, all the Necrons are awakening. So
they did the story. Well, they did two things. One,
yeah,
they made it so that all the dynasties are pretty much the most backstabbiest of backstabbers. They're all looking for an opportunity for them to jump up and climb the ladder. And then you've got this side project, or side, sorry, not project, but problem, which is a destroyer curse. And then some people, cough, cough, Amintar.
He's new. We can mispronounce it with reckless abandon.
But he really leaned into it and has been forcing the destroyer curse on people. And the destroyer curse is pretty awesome in the fact that it's just kind of what they originally had the Necrons at, which is just destroyers of life.
Well, this is why I love the destroyer curse. So let's talk about it real quick. So the destroyer curse is something that, and it's almost a retcon, but it's not. So as the Tomb Worlds have begun to awaken from their deep slumbers, you get issues, you know, failed power supplies, planets that cracked in half, and I think they're lost in the void. A certain Necron who woke up 10,000 years ago and kept stealing all the crap out of them before they could wake up, you know?
Also, the fact that you have multiple Eldar craft worlds cruising around.
Just hunting for them.
For Necrons, yeah.
Yeah. But one of the weird ones that popped up is this thing called the Destroyer Curse, which there's a lot of hints that might be older than we think here. There's nothing written about the Necrons knowing the true origin of it, but the function of it's very clear. If you contract the Destroyer Curse, you become obsessed with one thing and one thing only, the absolute obliteration of all organic life in the galaxy. Everything. It has to die. And to quote a very good movie, they cannot be reasoned with. They do not feel pity or remorse or fear. These Necrons will not stop until everything is dead. But the cool thing about this is it actually is what Brad was hinting to, is kind of a retcon, because Necrons are one of the older codexes, third edition, if I'm not mistaken, right? Yep.
Yeah, and originally they were just Terminators. You didn't have destroyers back then. You just had Immortals. You had Lords.
Warriors, Lords, Immortals, Overlords?
Yeah. You just had the HQs. But you had the old Veil. You had the Veil, the Orb. But you just had Terminator bodies. Slightly bigger Terminator bodies and slightly smaller Terminator bodies. But they were just looking to eliminate life.
Yeah, and this was a different era of GW, and I like this a lot. So the Necrons were just, they were the Terminator. They hated all organic life. This is what their lore said. They hated all organic life, and they were looking to exterminate in the galaxy. In fact, I was recently, because of our last cast, replaying some Dawn of War, and I was playing Dawn of War Dark Crusade, and it actually, and it calls out, the Necrons rose up hating organic life to snuff it out. Now, that game's 05, 06, so we're like, fourth edition. So this is like what the lore was forever. And this was, you know, this is kind of the older GW mechanics were a little bit simpler. The Tyranids eat the galaxy. Necrons kill the galaxy. Chaos convert the galaxy to evil. Imperium conquer the galaxy. Orcs fight the galaxy. Eldar irritate the galaxy. Maybe that was basically kind of, that was basically what they all were. But as the game grew, it expanded.
And they had to flip it because they also got, with the development of the Black Library, they put out more and more novels, they fleshed out more things, and they had to make it deeper and more layered. The Necrons were dynasties. They actually want to reconquer the galaxy. There's a lot of stuff in some of the books where they would like to get bodies again. Some people don't want to, including the Stormlord.
They're right.
Why would I ever want to do that? This body's awesome.
Yeah, I'm a god.
Yeah.
But the thing was, but GW does these scenarios I really like. And I crap on GW a lot. But I also make sure I give them credit where it's due. They go out of their way to not create canon conflicts unless they absolutely have to. They do not like erasing prior canon with new canon. They always try to clarify. Like with Titus. Titus was the captain of the second company. But unfortunately, there actually already was a Captain Second Company. So once the Space Marine 2 got popular, they just released a couple of White Dwarf articles that just kind of cleaned up the timeline enough. It never conflicted with anything before. They just cleaned the timeline a little bit. And then there's the squats, which in which case they did say, all right, never mind. We can't fix this. The squats never existed. Votan's here now. Yeah, it is what it is. But they try to avoid doing that as much as possible. With the Necrons, they did a really good idea. The idea was, all right, the first Necrons that the galaxy encountered were actually this destroyer cult one. And that now the more complex ones have awoken. And this way, it covers the early writing by saying, well, yeah, those early ones did just want to snuff out organic life. But the ones you're seeing now, they've got a bit more stuff going on. It's just, it's cool.
I also like it a lot because of the fact that you go with the early ones weren't led as well. Because of the fact that you're going to think that 90-some percent of all the Necrons you're going to encounter are effectively rubric remains. They're soulless automatons.
Yeah, I was about to say, exactly. They're Thousand Sons. Yeah. It's their Thousand Sons without magic.
Remember, when they were putting him in the bodies, there was a Catan sitting next to it going, let me have a little bit of that soul. Yeah. Let me have a little bit of that. So you got all these just husks running around that are led by, and you originally had the protocols on it so that, you know, the Silent King could make everybody do whatever the hell he wanted to do, which was a big deal on that.
But then that went away. And so the thing about Necrons to always remember is Necrons are a rip of ancient Egypt, more than mythology types. I'm going to say mythology. It's not true ancient Egypt, but kind of what we look at ancient Egypt as from like a, you know, boyish charm, like the mummy, where you have lords and overlords, which are the pharaohs, and they would rule like Iron Fist. They were, in effect, gods.
They ruled like gods. Yeah. It was more like Stargate.
I knew it was going. I actually was. Randomly, I was with a friend of mine. We somehow were discussing Stargate SG-1. And he's like, oh, yeah, I remember that show. And I went, don't go rewatch it. He was really like, I mean, I'm not saying it was bad. I'm just saying when you rewatch it, it may not give you the same warm and fuzzies. But the issue that you had is that with these destroyer cults, some of them, it's not like the whole complex gets it. Only a few pieces within it will now be overrun with this. And so as long as you don't cause a problem for that overlord, they actually kind of like these guys because they're like, oh, cool. I've got this thing, these little Necrons over here who just want to kill organic life. So like they're almost like a little mini Eversor assassin, just my Diet Coke and Mentos. I shake it and throw it in the battlefield and like, all right, deal with it. You know, like. Yeah, exactly. But the flip side for the Necrons is every now and then, though, the destroyer curse hits the Lord or the Overlord, who then forces his entire army. Because remember, they are soulless automatons. They do not, if the Overlord says, kill all organic life, they don't sit there and the thralls don't go, but hey, shouldn't we be trying to reconquer the galaxy and control chaos? They're like, all right, I'll go hit that thing with a stick.
It's why Amentor's are so crazy now is because he's force putting the destroyer curse on other people too, people that he wasn't leading. So that's pretty crazy. It was also cool in the writings a lot of times too.
Yeah, the writing on this book is actually pretty cool. Antar gets really wild. And so what's happened now in the last 15 years of Necron writing is we've created a few like subsets within the Necron. So originally they were just kill all organic life. And now it's actually, no, it's a bit more broken up. And so now we've got the greater Necron forces have awoken.
Now we have this Necron. All the Necrons are coming up. And when I say all the Necrons are coming up, it's such a big deal because it's full dynasties are now awakened.
Yes.
And that is huge. But it makes the writing well because of their having their civil war. It means that the Imperium isn't auto losing. Because you have a reason, because these dynasties have their own goals in between that. It's not just Necrons are coming out. It is Sawtek and, you know, all the different dynasties are showing up and that each dynasty wants to be the ruler of everything.
Right. But within those dynasties, this is more interesting. This is what I'm referring to now is less in the 500 worlds and more in the infinite and the divine. Just so people understand kind of where I'm pulling this from, because some of you may be reading the 500 worlds going, John, where are you pulling any of this from? A lot of this is out of Infinite and the Divine, where they talk a lot more about the destroyer curse being this massive fear within the Necron leadership because they don't know where it's coming from. It is an, they know it is an infection. They know it has no cure. They have no way of detecting it till it happens to you, and they don't know where the transmission is coming from.
They have no idea where the origin is. Terrifying. So crazy. Mm-hmm.
And you effectively lose your sanity to it. You, even a noble will, they lose, they can't think. They just have to kill. They actually do cover it pretty well in the latter part of the 500 worlds, where you just become, you lose almost like your tactics. It just becomes, I have to go and attack and kill.
But to be fair, now they're saying that some of the lords retain higher functions now. Amintor is one of them.
For periods of time. Yeah. And what the GW did here is really nice. So what we get now in this book is a clarification on the Destroyer Curse, which also now is called the Destroyer Cult. So the idea is you can kind of join it, although it doesn't sound like you join it always by choice. But yeah, and so because it's like this like spans multiple dynasties, and it's like almost like an internal religion within the Necrons. And it's because now you've got higher functioning lords and overlords who have now joined the Destroyer Cult. These ones seem to be able to maintain a portion of lucidity with, as opposed to the rest of them. You know, we'll talk about flayed ones in a minute here, who are just, like, although flayed ones aren't even Destroyer. Yeah, but they're just gone. They're pure killing machines.
But I actually think that, I'm going to give a Brad theory. Mm-hmm. I think that's part of the Destroyer. I think that it's not just a flaw. I think that it's insidious because they want them to have whatever the Destroyer part. You need someone with tactics to go kill.
Well, yeah, it's also honestly it's good writing, candidly, because otherwise you could just snuff them out if they're just like, oh, all they ever do is kill organic life. Like, okay, so they're stupid. Yeah, all right, here's a trap. That was easy to do. We'll put a bunch of the Tyranids are over there. Just send them into the Tyranids. Oh, look, it's problem got so like two birds, one stone, whatever. And that may be something that they'll do, but candidly. But let's talk about the Destroyer Cult itself, because the Destroyer Cult has a few different types in it. So the original is what we all saw on the tabletop for a while, the hover platforms that shoot. That was what we had.
That's all they did, though. They were long-range firepower and medium-range firepower, but they weren't actual close combat threats.
Yeah, which was weird because, this was kind of a bit of a retcon. So the original Destroyers, the ones who are obsessed with killing all organic life, were long-range shooting, one of which was good at blowing up vehicles. Anyway, so then in, I think it's the 9th edition Codex, I'm not mistaken, we got a ton more units. Yeah, it was 9th edition, where we got, and these things were beautiful. Scorpex, Orphidians. I mean, now we're getting the melee Destroyers, which do look really good. And this makes me want to have a Necron army again, because these things look super awesome. These ones really fit more into the Destroyer Cult concept of, they have these long like blades on their hands that they use to kind of slice and dice. Some of them, like I believe it's the Orphidians, can actually tunnel through the earth to then pop up behind you and kill. These things are designed for just pure melee carnage. And so I mentioned earlier that some lords will keep Destroyer Cult inside their army. You can imagine how great this would be to have, like having some Scorpex, for example, and be like, all right, oh, there's a bunch of Imperial Guardsmen there. Cool. Just drop the Scorpex over there and let them do their thing. We'll pick them up later. You know, it's just like, there's a blender. Next issue. Really cool stuff. This is what it was until this book. There were members of the Necron Society who were, you know, prone to murder, unadulterated. Well, they're all prone to murder, but just they were obsessed with killing organic life, and they were being used by the Necron overlords to do it. One side note are flayed ones, though. And I do want to let people know there's a difference here. Flayed ones are not Destroyers.
But they flayed are ones, hilarious in the worst kind of way. When you have someone that goes, I'm going to sneak into humans. What's the best way? I'll skin a human and wear him over top of my robot body and no one will be able to detect us.
Yeah, flayed ones are not Destroyer Cult, but they're kind of Destroyer Cult adjacent. Yeah, where you find one, you find the other. That's kind of the best way to put it. So the flayed ones, because the flayed ones, we know the cause of their infection. It was a C-10. There was a C-10 named the flayed one. When they broke him apart, he seemed to have spread out and infected a bunch of the Necrons that had killed him. And they became kind of like phantoms. So much like the Destroyer Cult, they became obsessed with killing organic life. Like their robot bodies would actually go and try and eat which they don't have a digestive system. They would try and eat, you know, organic things. Blood would be all over the place. Like, their gait gets changed. Like, they actually hunch over. They get sharpened their fingers and these long blades. They're just, I mean, they're Terminator murder zombies, what they're supposed to be. But what's cool about them is they don't live in the materium. They live in a pocket dimension, which, by the way, again, the Necrons are really good at creating pocket dimensions. So why didn't they just go into one of those to hide from the Eldar? Right.
Because then they wouldn't have this, because they would have showed up and killed everyone instantaneously.
That's fine. I mean, what the Flayed Ones do is they live in this pocket dimension that no one knows where it is, but they do. And like a demon of Khorne, if they sense enough blood and carnage, they'll just pop out of it and come take part in the blood and carnage and kill a bunch of things, then go back into it. And the Necrons, as we said before, they use cryptex to do math and figure out like the future. They'll actually design battle plans to create the exact type of carnage that they know will attract Flayed Ones to then effectively surprise their enemies and have the Flayed Ones come in, which is why your Flayed Ones should never start on the board. They should always come in
Flayed Ones
in turn
just have
three.
Better rules. Flayed Ones have cool, don't get me wrong, they infiltrated the game, but like,
these rules suck.
They used to have the minuses and stuff, because the whole point is they're doing all this stuff to so fear and confusion and everything else with all the gruesomeness that they do.
Yeah, no, Flayed Ones in 10th edition are a functional unit that does things for you to score points. They're not Flayed Ones. Yeah. Flayed Ones were actually awesome at one point.
If you go, Firefly Serenity, they're robot reavers. You know what I mean? They're crazy.
Yeah, they used to reroll wounds. Yeah. Oh, they were so cool.
Remember, they used to cause checks and stuff because of the fact that because they're wearing your dad's head on your shoulder. And
they're covered in dead things. But I just want to make sure that the Flayed Ones are a little bit separate. The Destroyer cult is unique to this. So let's talk about Necrosaur Amentar, who we're just going to call Amentar going forward because it makes our lives a lot easier. At least in the 500.
I love everything about the fact that he has a title that no one knows what it is or where it came from.
But sort of. They went hard. They went ham on this one. First off, they made an incredible looking model, which is really, really awesome.
Too.
Ton of narrative about him. But what I like about Amentar is that he shifts the Destroyer Curse around a little bit. So yes, the Destroyer Curse is obsessed with the destruction of all organic life, but the whole idea is that they normally have no tactical prowess whatsoever. I mean, like a warrior who's affected with this thing will just run at you with its thing, shooting blindly, and then will try and hit you with its, you know, Gauss rifle. They're not as accurate. All the stuff that normally makes them good becomes crap. The lords and overlords who fall to them are actually, they just go into rampages. It's kind of all they do. So with Amentar, he actually shifts this around a little bit and makes it, and actually adds leadership into that. So how? Well, first off with Amentar is his, to Brad's thing, his title is Necrosaur. Necrosaur is a Necron title. It's a title that only could have been granted by the Silent King himself. But there's no record of his existence anywhere. And the Silent King is back and doesn't seem to know who he is either. So it's this really weird kind of fun thing of where did this guy come from? It's possible, but they're almost hinting that the Destroyer Curse may actually have been there from 65 million years ago. Yeah, it may have actually always been there.
A real problem for other Necrons, the Necron leadership, that is. Because of the fact that he also seems to have the ability to force this on other Necrons.
Yes, cryptex with him. Right. And he will conquer. He will attack a tomb world, conquer the tomb world, and then convert that tomb world over to destroyers. Like mentally too, not just like, all right, you guys, you're fighting for me now, I've conquered you. No, he actually is able to change their function, whatever you want to call it, reprogram them into it. So he's actually growing.
He's got to be terrified. For the lords and the overlords have to be terrified of him, because he's doing like basically lay on hands, you're converted kind of thing.
Right. But that also, if you think about it, goes to, again, this is John theory, but it does imply perhaps this is where the Destroyer Curse really comes from. Maybe this has been going on for, like I said, we have Trazen's been around, just kind of floating around. It's possible that this guy's been slowly infiltrating, doing all this stuff. Because to Brad's point, he commands a legion now of Destroyer cult members. And some of them, he actually even has leaders who have strategy, communication, you know, command powers, etc. We don't know how many tomb worlds he spans, but it's a lot. He's conquered numerous worlds and turned them into his service. He's got these cryptechs, these canoptic constructs, necrons, everything. He has a giant army. He has monoliths that he's able to bring along with him. And, you know, it's not ideal.
And remember, necrons do have instantaneous communication, so he can do his...
That's the other thing, too, is he's able to spread around and instantaneous travel. So he has the ability to reach, not only reach around the galaxy, but also warp around the galaxy.
Well, let's talk about why he's a big problem. Not just because he's insidious, Necron leadership. Oh, yeah. Did I mention that he's unbelievably obsessed with the Nightbringer? He wants to worship him effectively as a god, wants to grab all the shards of the Nightbringer and bring him back, which is a... Like, as far as bad ideas go, that's high up there.
Yeah, this is pretty colossally terrible idea, we think. I mean, GW, on occasion, we'll do some good writing where they'll be like, actually, this turns out to be a great idea. But yeah, Antar is Pokemoning his way through the galaxy on Nightbringer shards. He's just hunting them down, and wherever he finds it, because he has a natural... They speak to him effectively. They call out to him. So he knows where they are and he hunts them down.
I recommend people look at the lore of the 500 worlds because some of these battles are pretty funny. And I love the fact that he has the Imperium has claimed victory and they did win. But then Amintar is no longer there and the shard's not there anymore. And you're like, so did we win or did we lose?
Amintar is collecting these Nightbringer shards, and his goal is to bring the Nightbringer back, we think. I say we think, because he's collecting the shards, but he's never releasing the Nightbringer. He's keeping the Nightbringer shackled to the cryptechs, because when every C-Tan shard has, like, cryptechs that shackle to it. You don't see it in the model, but that's why, like, on the tabletop, if you're playing a C-Tan shard, it's not free. If it was free, it would attack everybody. They tend to they're not big fans of Necrons. So they don't look over them and say, oh, hey, the guys who murdered me when I was a whole thing, I can't wait to fight side by side with you. They tend to do more of the opposite. So even Amintar, when he grabs these Nightbringer shards, he still doesn't release them, which is a really key piece.
The thing is, I do like the fact that they give it. We were talking about it before we went live, before we started recording, of the fact that he knows that to kill everybody's this monumental task. The writing in GW says it's like trying to empty the ocean with a thimble, but he feels that if he can get the Nightbringer, then he can achieve his goal of destroying all life. But also, this is still a problem because you still got to convince the Nightbringer to not just mow down everybody around
him. Yeah, and that's the whole thing. If you were to put all the shards together, I don't think the Nightbringer is going to give a lot of thank yous.
No.
Just candidly.
Well, you mean the Gitan that was killing other Zetan during the war?
But yeah, with all that, let's get to Titus.
We'll be right back after a quick break.
In my professional life, one thing I know well is how challenging managing a global team can be. Just the act of creating one has been extremely challenging over the years. Because the one thing you learn quickly is the difficulty of hiring global talent and how unclear the costs can be. It looks simple at first, then the fees start to stack up with compliance worries, contractors versus employees, and a host of other regulations. People brings clarity with upfront, all-in hiring costs and enables you to hire the world. People is an AI-powered human resource platform built for founders, HR leaders, and operators who are hiring and supporting teams around the world. People helps you hire, pay, and manage talent in over 185 countries with fast onboarding that can be done in minutes. Instead of juggling separate tools for contracts, payroll, benefits, and compliance, People brings everything together with built-in compliance and local expertise to support you. This is especially helpful if you're managing teams internationally or planning to grow. The fastest growing companies in the world use People to stay organized and reduce risk and founders use it to scale faster without feeling like they need to become HR or compliance experts. Bottom line, it simplifies global people operation so you can spend more time growing the business and supporting your team. People's new standard discounted pricing is only $399 per month per employee. That helps you contain costs. Go to hipeble.ai to get a free estimate. That's hipeble.ai for a free estimate. 40K Lorecast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are all things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings may vary. Not available in all states or situations.
Last week, we covered that the campaign to reclaim Ultramar, Titus was given like the job of free agent problem solver. Each of the Tetrarchs was given the task of reclaiming their section of Ultramar, but Titus was given a fleet and a purpose, and he was the sword of the campaign to just bring a wallop wherever it was really needed.
Let's throw it out there. He also got some pretty cool stuff, and I want to see what they're doing, the games and stuff with it. I'm talking about the video games and possibly on the board, because he's got a bunch of new technology, which is pretty cool for the Imperium because they're so backwards in it.
Yeah.
Because his ship has a bunch of ways to board that you normally didn't, ways to engage on that.
Yeah, for now. I mean,
for now,
GW writing. It's GW writing. They might just go, "Oh yeah, that was the." It's always, is this a one-off, or do we just get more of this?
I just like they talk about his ship and the fact that it's got a bunch of new tech and ways to board and everything. I think it's cool.
All right, it is cool. I was always like, man, whenever they do the thing about GW, when GW does ships, it's always like, are you guys going to stay on this, or are we just going to drop this one suddenly because you stop? Because I like Battlefleet Gothic a lot, and then sometimes they'll just be like, "Oh yeah, Battlefleet Gothic, we have ships in this game," and they just kind of, and they give you a little bit of lore, then forget about it for 6 years. But anyway, so with the campaign in Ultramar, rogue traders went around there marking places, and one of the places they marked is the system of Heliodros, it being really high importance, and it had three key planets. The first is a feral world. It was just humans with a stable atmosphere, and the idea was over time this could be a really good addition for Ultramar. Good recruits for the forces of both, you know, the defense forces as well as Ultramarines. So nice future planet for the war effort. The second is the pre-Hive world of Nova Magnor. This world actually had been effectively separated from Ultramar. There'd been some conflicts there, but they'd actually maintained full loyalty to the Imperium. Yeah, when tithe ships showed up, they always paid their tithe. They are part of the Imperium. So perfect world for the Ultramarines to visit and bring into the fold of Ultramar. But that had to wait, because the third world was an agri world named Idaris. And Idaris...
and why it had to wait? Because the Tyranids were currently going... agri worlds are delicious.
Yes, there was a Tyranid Hive fleet tendril on it at that moment in time. And so Titus gets the phone call of, hey, there's a Tyranid Hive fleet tendril here. Yeah, and he did the, give him props. On my way.
Yeah. Instantly YOLO swaggins in there too.
And this is awesome. Yeah, so the Hive fleet is at Idaris. It's coming in. It's the tendrils reaching down. Titus wastes zero moments on this one. He translates into orbit, basically next to the Hive fleet, and just starts opening fire into it, completely blowing a hole in the side of the main Hive ship. And then a bunch of Ultramarines go into said Hive ship.
Actions into the Hive ship. Yeah. It's so hardcore.
Yeah, full boarding torpedoes, then Thunderhawks going in after the boarding torpedoes made enough space, and then just fill this thing like a pinata with melta bombs and blow it up, which I am assuming was extra gross looking. Like, just like so gross.
Ew.
But then they're not done, because the Tyranids on the surface are still pressing the attack. And so Titus, you know, Captain Death Watch over here. Get it, Captain?
Yeah. The thing is, I like this would be right because of the fact that Titus has a long history with the Death Watch. So he recognizes that there are still coordinated. The Hive ship is exploded. We've done this stuff. But on the surface, there's coordinated attacks going on, which means that there are Synapse creatures there, or it would not be. And he knows this because of his time with the Death Watch. So he reacts to it pretty instantaneously. We have to start chopping these guys up too.
And this is, and the other thing to remember here is that this is an agri world. So they cannot take the risk of just bombarding it like they could a lot of other places, because if they do, then they have less food for Ultramar. So they have to go down there and deal with it. And Titus grabs his crew and they go, they start looking effectively. Brad was talking about, or their ship has better scanning, but it's 41st millennia, so the scanning still sucks. And they're looking for,
let's talk about what he actually did. Titus put on his boots of mighty ass kicking, grabbed a legion of named characters. he did a Star Trek and went, everybody that is a named character, you're with me. And also you, guy. You
know, yeah. Oh, there is a, yeah, he did bring a guy with him, but that's fine. So he goes down there and hunts down a Tyranid Prime and he kills him himself, which I really like, by the way, because this is a little side note. Titus, I love Titus and I do think he's a badass, but I really hate in the writing when like a single space marine kills like a hive tyrant or a lord of change or a demon prince. Because GW in those moments, they think they're making the space marine look really good, but really what they're doing is they're making the signature piece of another army just look like a dud. And so for people who don't play the game, here's an example. Titus is 90 points. So if in a 2,000 point army, I can spend 90 of my points on Titus. A Tyranid Prime is 65 points. So Titus killing the Tyranid Prime in hand-to-hand combat kind of makes sense. A Carnifex, something that Titus kills in the video game, is also 90 points. Okay, it makes sense. They're kind of on even footing. A Hive Tyrant is 195. Or you know, no.
Flies.
If he flies, actually less, but it's a weird, different point balance. It's complete for you and I in different time. But I don't like that. I don't like when something kills something that's 2.5 times its point value, because you're like, wait, so is it overcosted? What's going on here? It doesn't make sense for someone like, I'll let Khalgar fight the Swarm Lord. That's fine, because they're actually pointed fairly similarly, honest.
In the game, if Titus fought a Hive Tyrant, he would get punted into the sun. But continue.
That's my point. And that's how it should be. So I did like, just real quick moment, he fought a Tyranid Prime, which might sound like, oh, it's just a Tyranid Prime. That's what he's supposed to fight in hand-to-hand combat. But Tyranid Prime is dead. Hive ship is dead. Now the Tyranids and Nidara start to turn feral, and the cleanup operation begins. And they call it a three-day operation. They kill every Tyranid on Nidaris, which is pretty impressive, because there's planets in the Imperium that are still trying to, there's planets in Ultramar that still have Tyranids on it from the Behemoth invasion.
Yeah.
So good one, Titus. Maybe
they did win. They started to clean up, but again, because he was part of the Death Watch, and it's a nice, I like the fact that they have him recognize these things and they don't spring it on.
Exactly. So he does this great thing. He sits there and he does it. The rule the Death Watch has is when you stop a Tyranid invasion, remember the Tyranids, they just consume as they come in. So the question is, well, where did they come from? And the hard thing about Tyranids is you really can't track them live, but you can track them with hindsight. So with hindsight, you can look at, okay, they are here at Eudaris. Now I can look back in time and look for these shadows in the warp to see how that hive fleet moved, because it won't necessarily black out communications in there, but it will disrupt it a little bit. And you can track it. And so they see it. It actually takes it outside of Ultramar, I think into the bottom right portion of the galaxy out there. And so they can mark where it is. But Titus notices something more important. The Tyranid fleets move in straight lines. Everything's as the crow flies, unless there's another problem. And so this, as a crow flies, should have come right into the system.
Except it went massively around.
Yeah.
They took a left turn at Albuquerque with bugs.
Yeah.
And went, yeah, we don't want anything to do with this particular planet.
Yeah.
Which they figure that out too.
Yeah. Titus notices that Nova Magnor is directly in the path, and this whole hive fleet just went right around it.
There's only one thing that can mean, which is it's a tomb world, because the Tyranids, historically, they've learned. They also insta learn, they adapt, which they should do better in the game. We're not going to talk about that, but they've known we get nothing from fighting the Necrons. It's almost, it's a lose-lose for us. So there's no reason for him to go there.
And so Titus sees this and beelines to Nova Magnor with impeccably action movie timing. That was great. It's not good timing. It's just action movie timing. He arrives just in time for everything the Rogue Traders said about the planet to be wrong. Like, the Rogue Traders were correct at what it was. He gets there, and it was strong planetary governor, good infrastructure, powerful planetary defense force. Citizenry were all aligned with the Imperium. And that's what it was. When they get there, the planet is effectively coming apart.
Because there's giant pyramids, ziggurats ripping out of the planet's surface.
Yes. Yeah, this is, the entire planet is encased in an ominous green glow, just because that's what Necrons do when they come out. When Necrons phase up, by the way, like, the thing was, remember, they were in the core of the world. They're now not in the core of the world. There is now a giant void in the core of the world. So the core of the world sometimes moves around a little bit. So volcanoes,
they're effectively pushing tectonic plates to the left and right so they can go straight up.
Yeah. So the entire planet is also starting to go through volcanic eruptions. It is a complete nightmare planet. Cracks on the earth all over the place. Atmosphere is turning to ash. I mean, it's, maybe honest, it probably wasn't savable, but it's going to be savable. But I know what happened when the dinosaurs died. Huh. But well,
dude, let's go into when he shows up, though. Titus shows up and he rushes in to save the day. All this has happened. It's crazy. And what? A couple days before this, effectively, the governor had signed up to be a vassal.
Oh, yeah. This was awesome. Yeah.
And Titus shows up and he's like, we got this. I'm going to take control of the situation. And the governor's like, yeah, man. Go ahead. He's doing the Paxton from Aliens. I don't know if you're keeping score, man, but we just got our ass kicked. I mean,
this governor basically signed the best deal ever. He effectively signed like an insurance document a day, like 2 days before the catastrophe. Like, yeah. Oh, yeah. So if I join, so you guys are offering, if I join Ultramar, the Ultramarines themselves will provide me protection should I ever need it. He's looking at his plan going, yeah, it probably won't matter, but sure, I'll sign that. Fast forward 48 hours, and you've got a full Necron invasion going. And to his credit, the Ultramarine fleet arrives in orbit. He's like, all right, well, I guess this worked out well. What I like, though, is that Titus comes in a little bit hard, brings his whole fleet in, and they're ready to come in and attack. And as they do this, a Necron ship just phases in right above the main complex. And this Necron ship is phalanx sized. It is larger than the entire fleet. Was it the entire fleet?
Yeah, it's significant. They said it dwarfed the largest ship in Titus's fleet.
Yeah.
And we haven't really gave it props. Titus is commanding a monstrosity of a fleet, by the way.
Yeah.
I don't think we pushed that enough.
And this one giant flying croissant just appears, and it is a moment of, oh God, well, this book's going to end quickly. I think we're on like page 11. Yeah. But the ship doesn't engage the fleet, and actually instead starts to leave. And as it leaves, Titus notices that it's covered in score marks. This ship has been under attack.
Oh, and it's not just from score marks. It is heavily damaged. Yeah.
But Titus also is a student of the Death Watch, and he is a member of the Imperium, and he knows something. This ship is heavily damaged. It is not a threat to him right now, but Necron ships heal, and this ship is a massive threat to the Imperium at 100%. Incredible threat. So he has to go do something about it. So he then turns and starts chasing this ship that's leaving. And they catch up to it, boarding action, blah, blah, blah.
I'm so disappointed at you because you had an opportunity to say, focus everything on the Superstar Destroyer, which is what they just did.
It is true, yeah. They went everything on it. And they engage this warship, and macro cannon barrages, all this stuff, lance batteries, they're hammering it. And Titus and Mataris actually enter the ship themselves in a boarding action and start fighting their way through. And once inside the ship, they're noticing that there's just dead Necrons everywhere. Like, there has been a horrible fight.
It's not just a couple dead guys around. There is
piles.
Yeah. Yeah. Canoptic constructs are all over us. There's like this, he knows something has happened here, but they still have to deal with it. And they're, again, randomly, their tracking or their sensors work. It's always hit and miss in GW writing. And they notice that there's a mass in the center of the ship that's got a bunch of Necrons in it. So they start fighting their way to that. And they keep fighting. And once they get there, now they get resistance, actual resistance. There's a full Necron force there, and including an Overlord, who they kill. And
pretty quickly, by the way.
It's actually not that long. It's not that protracted of a battle. It's basically like, yeah, we have storm shields. Screw you guys. And then they're all dead. But in the middle of it, there's this weird device. And while they're planting melted charges all over it, they don't know what this one device is. So now in comes AdMech. AdMech are kind of the bad guys in all GW writing, by the way.
Yeah, because they're always out for the AdMech. And everything they do is so questionable. Even for themselves, you're like, that's a bad plan. They're like bad guys that get beat by the heroes every week in a TV show. You're like, it's never worked for you. You've never won once.
Yeah, it'll work this time. So within Titus's retinue.
The AdMech are run by Megamind.
No, that'd be a step up, if I'm being honest. The problem is, it's more like Starscream. It's just like, All right, so within the retinue is this guy, Archmagos Wybor Okt. Just Okt is more known as. So Okt, unknowingly to Titus, or even a lot of the Mechanicus itself, was part of a secret cult back on Mars. And this cult was aware of the Seitan of the Void Dragon on Mars. And they believed this Seitan was, in effect, the Omnissiah, or at least a bridge to the Omnissiah.
They considered the Catans angels of the Omnissiah.
Well, and it's interesting because what's fun about it is they don't know a lot about the Catans, but they do know that the Void Dragon they like, and the other Catans are pretty powerful too, but the Void Dragon is the one that they actually care more about. And it's probably safe to assume with the AdMech that what little knowledge they had also was totally jacked up, because remember, the Void Dragon on Mars is locked away behind a door that only the Emperor has a key to. And of all the people he'd let have access to that key, the AdMech might be behind Abaddon on that list. But this guy is a worshiper effectively of the Seitans. So obviously, they just found a Seitan. And so he walks in there and Titus goes, hey, we're going to blow this ship up. What's that thing over there? And Okt looks at it and says, oh, that's a weapon. And Titus goes, okay, cool. Blow it up. And Okt goes,
You shouldn't do that. It'll be better used later on to defeat the Necrons.
Well, what he says is kind of funny because Titus is on team like, I'm not a big fan of artifacts I don't know a lot about. They burned me a few times. So seriously, melt a bomb.
Two games in a row.
Exactly. Yeah. Melt a bomb out airlock. And Okt goes, if you melt a bomb it, it might explode itself. You might blow up the sector. So to which Titus goes, fine, take it with you, but also bring a melta bomb. And so Okt is able to then take this thing with him and they blow up the giant Necron ship. Okt obviously has every intention of freeing this Seitan because that's obviously what he's going to do. And he takes it back to the Nova Magna AdMech facility there for study. You know, the planet currently under attack by the Necrons. Could you have just flown it back to Mars or McCrag?
Yeah. Or literally anywhere.
Yeah, this is basically a horror movie thing of like, oh, so we had this
split
thing
up.
Yeah, we had this thing the bad guys really want. Where should we put it? Very close to them. Well, why don't we just put it on a ship and take it over there? No, the best place to hide it or to work on it, it's right next to the enemy. It's a terrible idea. I don't see how this could go poorly. So anyway, but warship's handled.
Spoiler, it did go terribly.
Yeah. By the way, warship is handled. Titus now has to get back to the surface. And the next thing he does is he goes down to the surface to help with the Imperial Governor. So they have to they deploy down around the main capital and just resecure it. Because first off, this is one of the best defended parts of the planet. So it gives you a nice little beachhead to deploy troops through and start making a peace. But also, it's a nice little mental piece of the local troops.
Well, I like this, though, because of the fact that I really do, having him, Titus is such a good character because of the fact that he's with the Death Watch. So he has reasons to have this knowledge that he know that he do stuff. But also, it makes for an exciting battle, which we get, because he kind of has to go into a quick battle. Because the longer you wait, the longer you let, while a Necron Tomb World is rising, they just get more and more powerful. Everything gets back online. So you want to hit them before they can get everything back to 100%.
Exactly.
So it makes a reason why that he's doing this very big push right away, because the longer you wait, the actual harder it's going to be. So he goes in with not the best forces he can go with. But it makes sense because of this.
Well, yeah, because it's not only does he deploy to the surface and pick the biggest, toughest fight, which is not what you should do. He has, because normally you'd be like, okay, they've got this one giant facility that's got a ton of Necrons in it. And he goes, yeah, we're going to go attack that. Why don't you just establish, you know, flanks, that kind of stuff? Because the problem with Necrons is not only will that facility wake up more and become a bigger problem, but also if it's part of a larger dynasty, that dynasty might establish contact and start just phasing in more warriors.
Yeah.
So now it's over. Yeah, you can kill everything else on the planet, but this now one facility has an infinite supply of warriors. Right.
It also it has happened in recent history with that, where whole dynasties would just ruin. The Marines were winning and all of a sudden they're losing. Because
the Marines are winning up. And then a million Necron warriors show up and you're like, that's not ideal.
Now, this is the coolest thing for me in the book, because Titus comes bootstrapped in, ready to rock and roll, and they get into this Necron ship and all of a sudden
Let's call it out. Let's call it out. What Brad's about to describe here, or is trying to describe here, is well written. It is exciting. It is cool. And it is a overused trope I have seen in 100%. More actors and read. It is a constant thing. And it's like you knew exactly what was happening on word 4. Of how this whole thing was going to go down.
You know what this does read like? If you played Mass Effect 2 when you're getting Legion and you go into the ship and wakes up.
You mean also Aliens?
Yeah.
Let's think. I mean, we can keep, there's a ton of these movies.
It's been done a billion times.
Anyway.
So there's tons of Necron bodies laying about, but not destroyed, just being seemingly deactivated with a faint glow in their eye.
Yeah, and a couple Ultramarines. Basically, it's obvious that there's been like a civil war inside the place. That you can see, because there are also destroyed Necrons. There are destroyed canoptic constructs. It's kind of a bit of a mess. And I do like the couple Ultramarines are like, hey, these Necrons are still alive. Can we just shoot them in the head? Because it seems dangerous. And Titus goes, no. If we kill them, then it might wake the rest up. No, man, like you're literally walking in and leaving them behind. You're surrounded.
Admiral Akbar shows up. It's a trap.
It's like, Jesus. Like, can we just put like, we don't have to kill them. Can we put like a melta bomb on them? Nah, we don't have time for that. Okay. Anyway, so they continue down the complex and they find this massive chamber. And this is actually, of course, the chamber that giant ship came out of. And their idea was they brought a vortex mine with them, which vortex mines are one of John's favorite things from a day gone by in competitive 40K.
Goddamn vortex.
Vortex mines are great. Vortex mines create a gap between reality and non-reality that then collapses back in on itself. Yeah. I'm a big fan.
It's worse than opening a black hole in the thing.
I'm a big fan of the vortex mine. 11th edition. Balls in your court, GW. Bring it back. Bring it back.
They're about to click the on switch on the vortex bomb when check all destroyer constructs show up. All of them.
Yeah. Locusts start firing from above. Scorpex, Hexmarks, Orphidians come out of nowhere. They overwhelm the Ultramarines in an instant. And also the pseudo-deactivated Necron warriors start to stand up. So they're very, very trapped. And then from they start fighting their way out of the chamber. So while they're doing this, I should have mentioned that they brought some tech priests with them to make the vortex mine blow up. And the destroyers killed the tech priests, which like kind of annoys me a little bit because I get that the tech priests are like masters of technology and like, but Astartes are also geniuses when it comes to combat. Like I'm okay with Astartes not being able to build a land raider, but it feels like they should be able to deploy a bomb, right? Like, doesn't it feel like something, an ultramarine, hell, a blood angel, like any, even, you know, no, no offense, space wolves, but like even a space wolf should be able to work a vortex mine, right? Just feels like the kind of thing they should be good at.
Push the button.
Well, like, oh, it has to be uncoded. Yeah, I can learn that. It's not, this is, I'm a freaking tactical genius. I can learn that. Fine. Take apart and reassemble. Because they take, that's right. Because they do. They take us apart and reassemble their own armor and weapons all the time anyway. Why could they do it? They have to bring a tech priest with them. One of the squishiest things possible. It's just, oh, we got to bring this guy with us or else the bomb won't go off. What the hell?
I love the fact that they can't get the bomb to go off. They lose the tech priest. They have to retreat. And the best part about this for me is red shirts fall like nobody's business. You just has someone said your name in this book? Because if they have it, you are going down.
Yeah, because as they're retreating, Amintar appears and comes in. And yeah, to Brad's point, there is like multiple like sentences of, and then this number of ultramarines led a rear guard action and all perished, followed by this chunk of ultramarines led a rear guard action. They all had red pauldrons. It weren't full red shirts, but I'm assuming they all had a nice red pauldron of like, you guys know what to do. It's just, okay.
Ultramarine plot armor activate. Oh no, my name's Guy. Damn it.
It is kind of objectively hilarious because they do this. So Titus and them, they all retreat, leaving the bomb behind, by the way. They eventually retreat back to the surface, and it's like almost aliens style thing. They get to the surface and then that's just okay. The Necrons go, they got outside. All right, I'm done chasing them now.
Right? They can't see him anymore. They're done.
Yeah, like they got outside. All right, like we can go outside too. Just throwing it out there. But it works. Thunderhawks pick them up. And Titus and the crew retreat back to the main HQ to kind of lick their wounds and figure out what they're going to do next. Needless to say, Titus is not happy. He doesn't take losses well, if I'm being honest.
Hey, but luckily for Titus, Ock went back to the Admech facility, and he's got a great plan of how he's going to stop all this from happening with the Shard of the Nightbringer.
Yeah, and by stop all this from happening, he couldn't care less. He just wants to open it because the Ock has a little bit of a problem. He can't unlock the vault that the Seatan's in because the one thing the Necrons did a good job of was, hey, what if someone stumbles upon this shard of a god? Yeah, let's make sure they can't open it. All right, fair enough. And then he can't. So, yeah. But we're actually going to break there. The reason we're going to break here is because next week we're going to conclude a bit more of this. We're going to have Titus trying to get his revenge, Antar coming in hard, Oct being useless.
Hot and heavy. Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's going to come in. It gets a little rough. And we're covering the kind of the conclusion of the Battle of the 500 Worlds. And also, I want to spend some time, Brad and I, talking about where we think this lore is going to go. There's some interesting hints here about what they can do with this, because I think we are both hoping that 11th edition, which we're a few months away from at this point, is going to get a nice jump forward in the lore, where we're going to get a bit more maybe good guy stuff, for lack of a better phrase.
We need some heroes. I need a hero.
Ugh, boo. Boo. But just boo. So next week, we'll conclude this, and then, we'll see kind of where we go. But till then, John Barsotti, Brad Chester.
This guy.